We're going to be talking about purinergic and pyrimidinergic transmitters today, things related to adenosine, with a few other vague relatives of adenosine as well, towards the end. It's a pretty nice day outside, so I'm going to try my best to get you out of here in a timely fashion today. Well, you can go outside for 10 minutes then. Call it a recess. Okay. All right, for those of you unfamiliar with adenosine, its structure is shown over here at the left. And then we're all familiar with ATP, adenosine triphosphate. And then its related cousin, cyclic AMP. These are phosphorylated forms of adenosine. We're also very familiar with receptor-mediated G-protein initiated cascades, intracellular. So ligands bind to receptors. They then have a life cycle for the G-proteins that results in the dissociation of the alpha subunits. What kind of alpha subunit would activate adenylate cyclase? A GS. What kind would inhibit? Or GOs, the members of the GI family. Okay. What's the substrate for adenylate cyclase? ATP. And what's the product? Cyclic AMP. Okay. Do we just worry about alpha subunits for G protein mediated receptors? What else do we think about? The beta gamma subunits. We're going to be talking about all of these things again today. So that was just by way of refresher again. Right, when we talk about metabolism of adenosine, if we start with adenosine down in this corner, it has to get phosphorylated so that we can end up with ATP. So adenosine kinase carries out the initial phosphorylations, takes you from adenosine to adenosine monophosphate, AMP. Again, an adenosine kinase adds another phosphate group, so you end up with ADP, adenosine diphosphate. And then not only can ADP, but multiple other kinases phosphorylate ADP to generate ATP. Where does this typically occur in cells? In the mitochondria. Okay. ATP, again, serves as a substrate for the enzyme adenylate cyclase, yielding the product cyclic AMP. Okay. Now, cyclic AMP can itself be further metabolized by the enzyme that's abbreviated here. What is this?
Phosphodiesterases.
Okay. Yielding the product 5' cyclic AMP, okay, an inactive form of cyclic AMP. And there's one relevant clinical drug, sildenafil. Sildenafil blocks phosphodiesterases. Blocks phosphodiesterases. So for instance, if we had a dopamine D1 receptor that had been activated, would sildenafil potentiate the effects of a D1 agonist? Or would it reduce the effects of a D1 agonist? It would enhance it because it blocks the degradation of cyclic AMP. D1, you would have to remember, acts through a GS to stimulate adenylate cyclase activity to increase levels of cyclic AMP. And sildenafil, since it blocks the breakdown of cyclic AMP, would amplify the effect of a D1 agonist, sustain it, make it last longer, make it more potent. Not by having anything directly to do with the D1 receptor, but by acting upon its second messenger pathway. Is that clear to everyone? Okay. So one relevant clinical drug for the day. Unfortunately, that's not the only one. But some of them are going to be really familiar to you and really easy to remember. Okay. All right, so if we're talking about adenosine, it can function as a neurotransmitter. As a consequence, we've got to have transporters for adenosine and related molecules. So there are three relevant ones for adenosine. First, we have what is called the nucleoside transporter. It carries adenosine, uracine, a whole variety of other related compounds. It can transport it across membranes. So that includes cell membranes from the extracellular space to the intracellular space, but they can work perfectly well in the opposite direction from the intracellular space out into the extracellular space. So we often see in the nervous system, for instance, non-vesicular release of adenosine carried by these transporters. We also, though, have typical calcium-dependent release of adenosine. So we are dependent upon vesicular adenosine transporters, or VATs, for vesicular adenosine transporters. And like almost every type of vesicular transporter, they're proton-dependent. So you've got to have protons present inside the vesicle to operate the transporter. These are ATPases, so they also utilize ATP as their substrate. And how do we get protons inside the vesicle? Using ATPases, pumps. Okay. Finally, there are cyclic AMP transporters. Cyclic AMP, for instance, needs to be transported out of mitochondria. Okay. Again, what was the protein kinase that is activated by cyclic AMP? PKA, which has both a regulatory and a catalytic domain. Which part of it does the cyclic AMP bind to? No, the regulatory subunit. Okay, and then that causes dissociation of the catalytic subunit, which is then free to go off and do the reactions that the catalytic subunit drives. The regulatory subunits are the ones that bind the activators or inhibitors. Again, we covered all this early in the semester, but that's probably for some of you an extremely long-term memory by now. Inaccessible long-term memory, apparently. So we're attempting to reconsolidate this information at this point in time. If I show you this picture about adenosine receptors, if you count the number of transmembrane segments, you'll find seven of them. Seven transmembrane segment receptors are also called tabotropic receptors or G-protein coupled receptors, GPCRs, G-protein coupled receptors, or metabotropic receptors. Okay, so they act through G proteins and then second messenger cascades. So how many types of adenosine receptors are there? Four, but three primary ones. And they're conveniently numbered 1, 2, and 3. Now here the nomenclature gets a little bit complicated, and I want to try to simplify it. They're called A1s, A2s, and A3s. But within this general family of things that react to something like adenosine, they're considered purinergic receptors or P1 receptors. So these are the ones that are sensitive to adenosine itself. hence the nomenclature A1, A2, and A3. There's actually two known subtypes of A2s, but for now we can safely ignore that fact, unless you're going to become an expert in adenosine receptors. Anyone here know that for certainty at this point in time? They're going to become an expert in adenosine receptors. Okay. For our purposes, then we'll say A1, A2, and A3. The endogenous agonist is the one that is sufficient to learn as an agonist, and it would be adenosine. Okay. There are other ones, but at this point in time, again, unless you're going to become an adenosine expert, I think adenosine is more than sufficient. There are some selective agonists for the various subtypes, the exception of one of the A2s. But again, you don't need to learn those at this point in time. The story is really more interesting for the antagonists. Who's ever heard of the word xanthine before? Many of you consume xanthines on a daily basis, in fact, multiple times a day. One that is most commonly encountered is this substance, caffeine. It's an antagonist for all of the adenosine receptors, A1, A2, and A3. Caffeine. Of course, you may encounter it in this formulation. It may be added to various other beverages as well. The whole concept of caffeinated water still seems very strange. Then we have the methyl xanthanes. And again, many of you ingest these substances multiple times a day. They're again antagonists for all of the A receptors, A1, A2, and A3. We have theophylline, which is found in teas. Theophylline, at least white, black, and red tea. There are lots of herbal teas, so-called, which do not contain any of these compounds. Theophylline, and then the related compound, theobromine, which is found in cocoa beans. So it's found in both cocoa and chocolate. So again, there's a liquid formulation, and then there are various other formulations as well. So the next time you have a chocolate bar, you could say, well, I'm having my drug dose for the day. Same thing, though, for your cup of coffee or cup of tea as well, or Coke or various other things that you like to take in. Those are all antagonists for the A receptors, A1, A2, and A3. Now, there are some additional ones. Again, unless you're going to become a specialist in adenosine receptors, I don't require you to learn those. What is useful to know is the G protein alpha subunit that's involved. For the A1, it's the GOs. So what does GO activate? Phospholipase C, as well as inhibiting adenylate cyclase. For the A2s, it's a GS-mediated pathway. So what enzyme would be activated? AC, and then downstream from that, what kinase? PKA. And finally, the A3s, similar family to the A1s, but a different member of that same family, the GIs. So just inhibition of adenylate cyclase. So the odd numbers share similar action, but the A1s have an additional mechanism of action. In fact, just to make life more complicated, the beta-gamma subunits of the A1s probably predominate in what we think of as the effects of the xanthine and methyl xanthine antagonists. The beta-gamma subunits have two primary effects. They upregulate the activity of GERKs. Does everyone remember what a GERK is? G-protein-activated, inhibitory, receptor-mediated potassium channel. GERKs. That's quite a mouthful. Even the abbreviation is long. What do GERCs do to membrane potential? Hyperpolarize it for very long periods. They generate a sustained outward potassium conductance. So they're very inhibitory to neuronal activity. Second effect of the beta-gamma subunits of the A1 receptors is to downregulate voltage-dependent calcium channels, particularly presynaptic ones, because these are primarily found on presynaptic terminals. What could that do to neurotransmitter release? Reduce neurotransmitter release. So if they're found on adenosine-releasing neurons, these A1 receptors, what else would we call these kinds of receptors? Autoreceptors. They're often, though, found on terminals that release other neurotransmitters. So there's ways for adenosine, then, to regulate the release of multiple other neurotransmitters. And it's thought that the primary effects of beverages like this, it's in this beta-gamma-mediated set of effects. General inhibitory effects on neurons. Does that make sense? Okay. So adenosine has long been known to play an important role in a physiological function that some of you are fighting against right now. Sleep. Give Disney his credit over here. Adenosine receptors, since the majority of neurons in your nervous system are glutamatergic and release glutamate, the most notable effect of these A1 receptors on presynaptic terminals is to decrease release of glutamate in your nervous system. Glutamate, typically excitatory or inhibitory? Typically excitatory, although we've talked about some inhibitory effects of it as well. Couple that along with the hyperpolarization, primarily seen on postsynaptic neurons, and then that effect of A1 receptor agonists, like adenosine, is to inhibit the nervous system. That correlates very strongly with sleepiness or grogginess or fatigue. The higher your adenosine levels in your extracellular fluid, if we did a spinal tap on you right now and drew out some CSF, we could get a real good idea of how tired you are. Anybody want to volunteer for that experiment right now? Wise choice. Spinal taps are sort of painful. We'd have to do it without a local here. Xanthine drugs like caffeine tend to be more potent at blocking A1 receptors than methylxanthines. So which was the xanthine?
Caffeine.
So caffeine, not surprisingly, is better at keeping you awake than tea or chocolate. Okay. It is a dose-dependent effect. So if you're really sleepy, you have to drink more coffee. Problem is, it's a competitive effect, and you're constantly generating more adenosine. And unless you can literally completely fill your nervous system with caffeine, the adenosine is probably going to win the race eventually and put you to sleep. I would not suggest trying to work out the dose response curve needed to stay awake perpetually. Caffeine has other effects, remember, on ranitidine receptors. You can do things like stop your heart with an overdose of caffeine. Again, you won't be sleepy any longer, but you will be sleeping permanently in that case. Okay. So again, just to emphasize, a lot of the effects of the A1 receptor agonists, like adenosine, are mediated through these presynaptic terminal receptors and through the beta-gamma-mediated effects on voltage-dependent calcium channels, decreasing release of neurotransmitters. If it happens to be on an axon terminal that releases adenosine itself, then we would consider that an autoreceptor effect. But in most cases, most of the terminals in the nervous system release other neurotransmitters, and therefore it downregulates release of other transmitters. Now again, adenosine can be released in a vesicular fashion, calcium-dependent fashion itself, but it can also be transported in and out of the membranes in a non-vesicular fashion. You always have levels of extracellular adenosine, but it varies, it increases as you get more and more fatigued.
In a non-vesicular fashion, does that mean it has channels, or is it
carried by the transporter?
Just by, but there's no other way that it gets through.
It's generated by lots of cells, not just neurons, too. Glial cells, muscle cells, all of them generate adenosine from using up ATP.
So, do you have adenosine transporters in other cells?
Every cell type in your body does, or you'd be dead. Okay. We look at the distribution of these P1 receptors, the adenosine receptors. They're extremely differentially expressed. The A1 receptors are highly expressed in populations like pyramidal neurons, but also the glial cells out here in the forebrain. Hippocampus, the thalamus, not nearly as much down towards the brainstem. A2 receptors, again, pretty widely distributed, but particularly in highly expressed in certain regions of the basal ganglia. So different cell populations have got different flavors of receptors responding to things like caffeine, tea, chocolate. We're just beginning to really scratch the surface on our understanding of adenosine receptors. An awful lot more needs to be done. Many of you are members of NSA, Neuroscience Student Association. Hopefully you got an email from me yesterday about a meeting we have coming up in May on the neuroscience of stress. Well, one of the speakers from Southwestern is also one of the best known researchers on the planet on adenosine. Starting his graduate work, he's a senior faculty member down at Southwestern now. His name is Robert Green. Clinically, again, we've talked a lot about the effects on arousal or sleepiness of A1 antagonists. People self-medicate for that all the time, have for thousands of years. Another important clinical application is of antagonists for A1s, A2s, and A3s of bronchodilation. Bronchodilation, treatment of asthma, so that people can breathe more freely than have asthma. One of the older drugs for treatment of asthma was not beta agonists, but was things like theophylline. People would literally inhale dried tea leaves to get the theophylline. Not probably the best route, considering that they had problem with their lungs being clogged up in the first place. But it was a good way to get direct application, because if you drink tea, it's got to go through your whole body. I wouldn't suggest trying to snort tea, particularly not the liquid one. There is a problem of drowning. So thankfully these days we have a little better drugs to apply. So a variety of other clinical uses. A2A antagonists are being tried fairly extensively now for modulating dopamine release in early stages of Parkinsonism. And A3 agonists are being tried after stroke as anti-ischemic treatments. Okay. So those are the adenosine receptors. The P1 receptors. The next class of receptors are for ATP. They're called the P2 receptors. P2s. Here the nomenclature gets more complicated. And I'm going to try to give you some easy ways to remember this stuff. There are 7 different types of receptors for ATP. They're called P2Xs, so P2X1 through P2X7. I wouldn't suggest trying to replicate the whole table. And I'll tell you why. It's too difficult to do this way. P2X1s through P2X7s all have ATP as their endogenous agonist. They all respond to ATP. They all gate a cation channel. They're not 7 transmembrane segment receptors, in other words. In fact, their structure is somewhat unique. They're made up of subunits that have 2 transmembrane segments. Passing the membrane twice. And each of the ion channels exists in a trimeric configuration. Except for the 2 subunits 3 times. So a triangular receptor with a central ion channel 4. This is looking at its crystalline structure from above. They're very, very complex receptors. Who wants to learn all the modulatory sites on them? Must be late in the semester by now. There's lots of phosphorylation sites, there's heavy metal binding sites. There's a number of sites for modulation by other extracellular signaling molecules. Nobody wants to learn all that? Okay, I tried. You can remember that they're trimeric receptors. That's a good start. Because that brings us to the next piece of information I'd like you to concentrate on. All of these 7 types, except for the P2X6s, can exist as homo trimers. So you can have one made up of 3 P2X1s or 3 P2X2s and so on, except for the P2X6s. They won't form a successful receptor by themselves. They have got to form heterotrimers with at least one of the other types of subunits. All the others can form heterotrimers too and be perfectly functional. But they can also, and they very commonly, form homotrimers, the same subunits. So P2X6s are different from the rest. They won't form a functional receptor. You just have P2X6 subunits. Besides the agonist, another useful piece of information, organized in a different fashion, is the antagonist for these P2 receptors. The first 3, P2X1, 2, and 3, and also the other odd one in the middle, P2X5, are all blocked by this drug, Suramin. P2X1, 2, and 3, and 5. Are antagonized by Suramin. P2X4 and this odd P2X6 and its neighbor P2X7 are blocked by a dye called Brilliant Blue G. So 2 antagonists to keep track of, Suramin blocks P2X 1, 2, 3, and 5. And Brilliant Blue G blocks 4, 6, and 7. Which one has to form heterotrimers to be a functional receptor?
6.
What do all the P2X receptors respond to? ATP as an agonist. Very complicated looking chart. You just told me everything you need to know about it. Each one has individual variants of ATP, exhibit some degree of selectivity for them. Again, how many of you are going to become ATP receptor specialists? For now, I think what you just repeated back to me is more than enough. Okay? What do we do with them? They're critically involved in peripheral nociception. What is nociception? Pain perception. Whenever you damage tissue, you tend to leak out a lot of ATP. That is perceived as a painful stimulus. Free nerve fibers contain lots of these P2X receptors. They're important in cardiac muscle contraction, in the smooth muscle contraction for blood vessels, and for the males in the audience, contraction of the vas deferens. What physiological response is mediated by the vas deferens? Ejaculation. So smooth muscle contraction and cardiac muscle contraction and pain. Pretty much things that you wouldn't be here if we didn't have these receptors. Okay. I think that's enough for everybody to absorb about P2X receptors, otherwise known as ATP receptors. Final class of receptors. Again, a really complicated looking chart, and we're going to try to make it simpler. Our receptors not just for ATP, but some related compounds. What's this one? Adenosine diphosphate. What's this one? Uracil triphosphate. Not adenosine, but uracil triphosphate. These are called the P2Y receptors. Probably because if people are going, why do we have to learn all of this? Not P2Xs, but P2Y receptors. Now, I wish the rest of the chart made any sense. Look at the names. P2Y1 and P2Y2. And so far, the pharmacologists are doing good on naming. Next one, though, P2Y4. For a while, there was a P2Y3, but people found out that it was an error, they were really P2Y2s. So that's gone from chart. So P2Y4s, 5, there were some other errors, but we only have 6 left. Very good idea. Lots of mistakes in this literature. 7, 8, 9, and 10 have vanished now, so we're only left with 11. I got lucky on the next one, 12 stayed around. How about this one? Did you think of a worse name? P2YAP4A. It's named for the endogenous ligand. AP4A. Do you know what that is?
Diadenosine tetraphosphate.
Diadenosine tetraphosphate, exactly so. Did you do your reading for today?
A little bit.
A little bit, good. Diadenosine tetraphosphate. Remember early in the semester we talked about the fact that there are lots of receptors that are dimeric? In fact, we just saw one that was trimeric. There are also ligands that can be dimeric. This is a dimeric form of adenosine with four phosphate groups attached to the two adenosines. This is the particular configuration of receptor that's agonized by that dimeric configuration of adenosine. About as ugly a naming scheme for all this stuff as you could possibly get. Don't blame me, I did not make these names up. Let's break it down a little easier. P2Y1s and P2Y2s and P2Y12s. We all have the number 1 and 2 in them, if that helps. Are all agonized by ADP. P2Y1s, 2s, and 12s. All have either a 1 or a 2 or both in their name. Are all agonized by ADP, adenosine diphosphate. P2Y2s, and the square of that, P2Y4s, are agonized by both ATP and UTP. ATP and UTP.
Did you mean P2Y6 for the first time? You said 1, 2, and 12 for ATP.
Sure enough, I did. Never mind about the 1, 2, and 12. Okay. 1, 6, and 12. Yeah, let's go back. ADP is an agonist. P2Y1, P2Y6, P2Y12. Okay, there it is, the 12, 6, and 1 might help you remember. P2Y2s and 4s respond to ATP and UTP. We already know about this one. It's dimeric adenosine tetraphosphate. What's left? 11, which is an ATP receptor. But it's not a cation one. It's instead mediated by a G protein. And in fact, it's uniquely mediated by a GI. All the rest of them are mediated by a different G protein, GQ. So except for the P2Y12 here, I'm sorry, P2Y, yeah. I didn't screw that up. P2Y12s are the GIs. P2Y11s are still GQs. I'm not standing in front of you with the white in my eyes. Twelves are GI. All the rest are GQs. Some of these are blocked by the drug Suramer. So the P2Y2s, 6s, and 11s are blocked by Suramer. The others we don't have good antagonists for. I'm not particularly interested in you learning some of these subvariants, the specialized agonists for them. If you go into a clinical specialty someday, like treatment of wounds, you're going to want to know a lot more detail than I could possibly fit on a chart like this. Agonist for the P2Y1s is ADP receptors are involved in coagulation of blood. Primarily through the receptors found on platelets. Antagonists for P2Y2s respond to ATP and UTP, also found on platelets. F is anticoagulants. And in fact, agonists for pretty much any of these P2Y receptors seem to play an important role in cell adhesion, making cells put out sugar molecules, for instance, to help stick to one another. And they're also found not just on platelets, but in the nervous system, often found on glial cells. Do glial cells ever wrap around other cells in the nervous system, like neurons, blood vessels? So these are actually pretty important to your daily function, P2Y receptors. Is that more than enough material to absorb for the day? I think the consensus is yes. That's it.